could explain to them that he'd been held hostage by ruthless revolutionaries, then everything would be okay. But he couldn't tell the Fed that it was all a mistake, because he was sitting in the bottom of a closet. The fear became too much for him after a while, and he began to hyperventilate. He wanted to scream, but he didn't really have the testicular fortitude to call any further attention to himself. While he hated being stuffed into the closet, he also felt that he was at least being left alone and not subjected to any more abuse. After his hyperventilation, he wept a bit, which made the inside of the pillowcase over his head wet and snotty. After that, he'd tired himself out, and he fell asleep. He awoke to the sound of soft footsteps approaching the closet. He twitched violently in the space, and his heart went from a resting rate to going absolutely haywire in his chest. By the time the feet reached the closet and the door creaked open, he was already hyperventilating again. But he had to do his hyperventilation through his nose. He was gagged, which caused big snot rockets to spew all over his face. "They're going to kill me," James thought. "I knew they were going to kill me. I should have fought back, or... Well, he knew he would never have fought back, and he tried to come up with an alternative, but none presented itself. He heard a loud snort, a rueful chuckle. "Oh no, it's him." Abruptly, the pillowcase was ripped off of James's head. It took a chunk of his hair with it, but he was too terrified to really register the sting. He stared up at the man with the big red beard. Kaz? Was it Kaz? He thought that it was Kaz. The man held one monstrous finger in front of his mouth and whispered, "Shh." James lay on the floor of the closet, wide-eyed and unmoving except for his chest, which rose and fell rapidly. Kaz looked over the man's snotty face and grimaced with undisguised disgust. "You know..." Kaz trailed off, shaking his head. "How in the fuck? That's what I want to know." He bent over James and reached around to the back, roughly spinning his body like it weighed nothing at all so that James's bound hands were presented.
"Because he's a nice guy," said a voice from behind Kaz, sharp and irritated.
Macy. Macy was there to defend him. Kaz made a raspberry noise. "He's not a nice guy. If he was such a nice guy, why'd he throw you under the bus?"
"When did he throw me under the bus?"
The hands that were working at James's restraints froze. Kaz's voice was incredulous. "When did he... in the car? Do you not remember?" He growled in frustration. "You know what? Never mind."
"Sounds good,"
Macy shot back. The restraints came off. James wilted. He was rolled limply, returning him to his back to stare up at Kaz. Except by this time, Kaz had his hand under the man's head. Gently. Like he would lift or lay down a baby. And he did lift James. Lifted his head and torso up off the ground until it was inches in front of his face, and James stared into those icy Nordic eyes. "You're getting the chance of a lifetime," Kaz whispered. "Don't fuck it up." James groaned behind the gag. Kaz briefly rolled his eyes, but then pulled the gag out of James's mouth. "No, don't start talking," Kaz said, cutting James off. "You just keep your mouth shut before we all change our minds." James kept his mouth shut. He felt the new breed's iron fingers tighten on the back of his neck. Those fingers could break his neck, he thought. Maybe pop his head right off. He was paralyzed, like a shark on its back. "You and Macy are getting out of here," Kaz said, whispering again. "You're gonna leave quietly and you're not gonna say a fucking word until you're off this property. And I want you to listen very carefully to this next part, okay? Because it's very important." James nodded, ready to receive. "If you tell the Fed, or any other government entity, or fucking anybody about anything that happened to you since the moment we met..." Kaz's fearsome joy suddenly flatlined. His eyes looked dead and serious. "I'll hunt you down and disembowel you." James was motionless. Then finally he nodded once. "All right, then," Kaz said, and with a heave, bodily lifted James upright and onto his feet. "I'm glad we have an understanding. Let's get you two the fuck out of here." Walter and Kaz were standing in the kitchen when Pete erupted from his bedroom. It was 2 a.m. The rest of the house was asleep. The car carrying Macy and James had just departed. Walter stepped into Pete's path and held up a hand. "Slow your roll." Pete looked at him with baggy, squinted eyes. "What are you doing?" he growled like an ornery cur. "We let Macy and James leave," Walter replied. Pete showed his teeth. "You stupid son of a bitch.
There was no need to kill.
There was every need to kill him.
Pete leaned forward, putting his face close to Walter so that Walter smelled the bitter scent of his sleep breath.
You know how long I've been doing this, sonny.
Walter didn't respond, just stared at the old man and wondered why had the prospect of killing James been so repugnant to him. And yet right here in this moment, he thought of how easy it would be to hurt Pete if he needed to. It made him feel off-kilter, disconnected. He wasn't himself. He was someone that he didn't know.
I've been doing this a long fucking time,
Pete answered his own question.
And when I say that we don't have rats in this fucking house, there's a fucking reason for it. You don't survive as many years as I've survived by making stupid fucking choices like that.
Pete grabbed his own face like he might pull it off and expose the skull. When he released himself, he pointed a blunt finger at Walter's nose.
You call them right now. You get them back here. I don't care what you gotta say to get them back here, but you-
I'm not calling them back.
You're gonna do what I fucking tell you to do.
I'm not doing that.
Those were the house rules,
Pete seethed.
Fuck your rules, Pete,
Walter said. I've got my own set of rules. He took the opportunity to lean in this time, and he felt the fire, that black, cold fire, consuming him.
You better think hard about who you're fucking talking to. You may not know me, but it might serve you well to think about how I came to be in this house of yours, and how far you should really push me. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Pete didn't shy away.
You're a fucking nobody.
Walter's lips quirked in a smile.
Oh, Pete, it doesn't matter who you are. It only matters what you're capable of. You think in 20 years anyone will care about who we were? No, they'll only remember the body counts.
Walter watched the man's face, and he didn't like what he saw. What he saw wasn't immediate conflict, but it was a wiliness, an accepting of the stronger man while simultaneously knowing that age and treachery will always overcome youth and strength. Pete nodded.
Yeah, sure, Walt. But you mark my fucking words. This is gonna come back to bite you in the ass.
Chapter 19.
Special Agent Brandon Goring was an early riser. He'd always been more of a morning person than a night owl, but that said, he did his fair share of staying awake at all hours. He was one of those people that could easily subsist on 4 hours of sleep a day. It just never seemed to catch up to him. His brain defied neuroscience. His sleep was actually a point of pride. While others struggled through a fitful 8 hours, Brandon Goring was in a deep sleep and sinking into REM just moments after his head hit the pillow. He never awoke at night, never suffered from anxiety or nightmares, always felt refreshed when his alarm on his PD went off. He never hit the snooze button. Sometimes people, suspects, terrorists, and even an occasional fellow agent would ask him how he slept at night. He enjoyed telling them that he slept like a baby. He woke up this particular morning as he did all other mornings. The light, rain and chimes tone of his alarm went off at 0400 hours, and Goring's eyes came open, wakeful and aware, like he'd only been pretending to sleep the entire time. The lights in his room came up over the course of 30 seconds, and by the time they were at full bright, he swung his legs spryly out of bed and stretched without a single yawn. He didn't drink coffee. He didn't take stim pills. His life was invigorating enough. The first thing he did when he was on his feet was check the hours on his chrono. Not the time, but the clock that was ticking away since he'd first put Roy Baucom back into his hole where he belonged. The chrono read that it had been 20 hours and 19 minutes. Just about perfect. Almost like a timer on a slow roast. Right about now, Roy was mentally sinking. You ever see an animal stuck in quicksand? Or a tar pit? Or even one that's being dragged down by crocodiles in some muddy confluence of the Nile? At first, they kick and scream and fight, but they eventually give up. They give in. They accept their fate. That was actually a problem for Goring. It was the panic that made them easy to break, and so it didn't do Goring any favors when his subjects began to accept the misery he put them in. You see, you have to have rises and falls, peaks and valleys. It's part of the experience. You can't feel the low parts if you're not falling from heights, right? Right about now, Roy's body had probably screamed itself out, and his mind was going into its shell like a threatened turtle, and that was a hard place for Goring to get to. The trick was to get them before they fully retreated inside, draw them out with something good. Right about now, Roy's muscles had probably locked him into a semi-fetal position. He had probably shit himself. Had probably pissed himself. He probably stank to high heaven. Goring stepped in front of the mirror in his room. He was nude. He always slept in the nude. His body was chiseled lean muscle, visible striations, very little body fat. He was a good-looking man, and he had a good-sized dick, which he admired in the mirror. This was a normal morning routine. It was good to see that he looked good. He reached to the ceiling, clenched his fists together, sank them back down so that he was in a classic power pose displaying his lats and biceps. "You're in control," he told himself. He spread his limbs like Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. "You're in control." He relaxed, flipped his dick a few times to fluff it up, gave himself a confident nod. "You're in control." Life was good. Everything was good. He flipped his PD open and tapped a frequent contact. "Morning," the voice said, still thick with interrupted sleep. "Barnes," Goring said, his voice powerful and clean. "Get Roy out of the hole and hose him down. At least get the shit off him. Then put him back in until I get there." There was a tired sigh, the sound of someone's hands being run over a face full of stubble. "Roger that. I'll get on it." "Thanks." Goring disconnected. Then he got down on all fours. Today was a yoga day. Goring walked into the main block of cells around which Black Site Evergreen was built. It was one big room, four cells on each side, interview rooms in front and back, brightly lit by large overhead lights. In the center of the concrete floor was a hole. Inside that hole was Roy. Goring walked over to him. He put his hands on his hips. He wore khakis and a black polo shirt. Casual attire for now. He wore his gun on his hip. The cells of Evergreen were empty. Roy Baucom was the one and only guest of honor, and he had Goring's full attention, which meant something because Goring was the AIC for the entire Southeast region, the very region that was going up in smoke at that very moment. So obviously he was a busy man. But he really thought that Roy was the ticket. His superiors were dubious. They wanted Roy executed and done with. But Goring wasn't so sure. Goring felt strongly that these Baucom boys were trouble. They were instigators, yes, and yes, they needed to be eliminated. But one Baucom boy could be used to catch the other, and both Baucom boys would have valuable intelligence if he could wheedle it out of them. In particular, Goring was very concerned about how a ragtag group of renegades had managed to take out a convoy guarded by new breeds. Of course, the convoy had been meant to fail. That's why he'd put the chip in the old man's head to begin with. The old man and several others, so that when the renegades came and freed their friends, he could track them back to their points of origin. But he hadn't expected the new breeds to die. They were only supposed to take a few hits and pull back. Regrettable. And also borderline impossible, unless the renegades had something to use against the new breeds, and Goring was confident that they must have. He stood on the grate over Roy's head and looked down at him. Roy was naked and shivering. He was still wet from being hosed down. His teeth chattered. His head hung down, staring at the floor between his cramped knees, which were red and angry from scraping up against the walls of his hole. On the other side of the hole from Goring, his fellow case agent Barnes and two tan-uniformed guards stood by. Goring gave Barnes a nod, and things moved like clockwork. The two guards got Roy out of his hole. He mumbled and whimpered, but that was it. No one said anything, except for the guards, who occasionally issued a curt command to Roy. They cuffed his hands in the front and then wrapped him up in a big warm blanket. Then they pushed him into an interview room and allowed him to sit in a chair. There was a heating unit there, spilling warmth all over him, melting him down. Lastly, Barnes brought in a tray of food and placed it in front of Roy. Barnes exited. The two guards exited. Just Roy, sitting in that interview room, warm and comfortable, with hot food in front of him. Buttered green beans, meatloaf, and a roll, all steaming and fresh. Goring waited patiently outside of the interview room, watching Roy with his hand on the door latch. The window in was a two-way mirror. He could see Roy, but Roy could not see him. Roy slouched there in his blanket, staring slack-jawed and hollow-eyed at the food in front of him. He knew what this was. He had to know. But that wouldn't change anything. Psychology was psychology, and physiology was physiology, and things happened in people's brains, and hormones squirted around, and there wasn't really much you could do to resist it. Roy made a decision and grabbed the roll like it might run away from him. He shoved the whole thing into his mouth, and as he crammed it in, Goring snatched the door open and strode in. Roy froze like a kid that's been caught sneaking treats. He stared at Goring. Goring closed the door behind him and offered Roy a warm, inviting smile. "Please, eat." Roy's nostrils flared. His eyes stayed locked onto Goring's. Goring ignored him, walked over to the other side of the table, and sat down in the chair that was provided for him. He scooted up, put his elbows on the table, leaned forward, still smiling congenially. Roy had begun to chew, slowly, like a beaten dog might take food from the hand of an abusive master. Goring smiled wider. His smile was genuine. At that moment, he knew that the warm blanket and the heater and the first taste of food was causing Roy's brain to dump dopamine into his system. Such wonderful relief after such agony. And what were his eyes looking at as those pleasure chemicals sludged up his brain? Why, Agent Goring, of course. Simple operant conditioning. When Goring was gone, the world was hell. And when he was present, the world was heaven. Comparatively, anyway. Goring was God, and his victims became his faithful, and they would all eventually fall to their knees and pray for him not to forsake them. And when that happened, and it always did, then they would do anything to please him. Goring, as always, was in control. He let Roy eat for a moment, really let that dopamine fix take hold. When he was about halfway done, Goring folded his hands together. "So, Roy, have you thought about what I told you earlier?" Roy's chewing slowed, stopped. He swallowed. He nodded. Goring's smile faltered, disappeared. He slammed the top of the table with one hand. "Use your words!" Roy jumped, swallowed again. "Yes," he husked. "Yes, I thought about it." Goring returned to his pleasant baseline. "Good." Excellent, actually. It was little things like this that made Goring so special at his job. He'd learned that one as a young man selling used cars for his father. A good salesman keeps his mark talking, conditions his mark into saying yes so that when the ultimate question comes, "Do we have a deal?" the mark is preconditioned to say yes. Goring didn't really care if Roy said yes, but he was conditioning Roy to speak. If he got Roy to speak to him for little things, then when it came to the big things, Roy's mouth would be moving before he thought about it. Tricks of the trade. "I'm glad that you thought about it," Goring said. He nodded towards the nearly finished meal. "Please, continue eating." Roy obeyed him, because it was easy to obey. "Were you hungry?" he asked. Roy almost nodded, but then caught himself. "Yes." Goring's smile wavered. "Yes, what?" Roy blinked, worried. "Yes, I was hungry." Goring nodded to show Roy that he had answered correctly. Specificity was important, too. Roy looked away, and a tiny frown just barely creased his brow. Perhaps remembering that this was not the first time he had gone through this conditioning. Perhaps remembering his long-ago experiences with Goring, which had been almost identical. And maybe Roy even had the thought that he should resist. But you just can't resist nature, can you? That's what was so great about it all. Goring was always in control. "What is your favorite part of the meal?" Roy seemed wary of that question. "What do you mean?" Goring remained kind. "Exactly what I said. What is your favorite part? Do you prefer the green beans? The meatloaf? The bread roll?" There were some conscious machinations rolling around in Roy's head, and it was painfully obvious to Goring. Most likely, Roy was wondering how the truth would be used against him. But then he must also think that there was a chance that the truth would be rewarded.
"The meatloaf," Roy said.
"It is good, isn't it? I had it last night. I was surprised." Which was bullshit, because Goring didn't eat the slop they had here.
"Yes, it's good.
Would you like to eat it again sometime?" Another pause to think.
"Yes, I'd like that."
"You were trying to free your old man from that convoy, weren't you?" Roy issued a flurry of blinks, like he was trying to process whether to admit to this or not. But the truth was already known. Goring knew it. Roy knew it. It was like asking whether the sky was blue. No need to get himself sent back to the hole over such a silly, obvious question.
"Yes," Roy mumbled. "I was trying to free my old man."
Goring felt the satisfaction of an anaconda constricting its prey. Every time Roy breathed out, the coils around him grew tighter. But you weren't there, were you?
Roy's jaw worked.
No, I wasn't there.
Why not?
Goring knew why not. Roy knew that he knew. This was part of the game.
I was prevented,
Roy said, trying to say enough without saying too much.
By the Udies.
Oh, right. Goring leaned back. That's gotta make you feel like shit, right? I mean, they get busted out of Sweetwater and you manage to tag along with them, manage to get yourself a good position, manage to be trusted by them, and then this. Then they sell you back to me for 4.5 mil.
Roy's nostrils flared. He didn't respond.
Doesn't it? Goring pressed.
Doesn't it what?
Make you feel like shit.
Yes, I guess it makes me feel like shit.
4.5 mil isn't even that much money, Goring observed, like he was reviewing the price of a particularly boring stock option. They just wanted to get rid of you. The money was just icing on the cake.
Roy looked down at his mostly empty food tray.
The raid, Goring said, leaning back. Was your brother there?
Ah, here was a good one.
Another obvious question. They both knew that Goring already knew the truth, but giving up his brother would feel like a worse betrayal. But this was one of those questions where Roy would really have to start weighing how much being shoved in the hole was worth, and he knew that he was going back there the second he stopped cooperating. Goring didn't need to threaten that. It had simply metastasized into a reality. Do you say a purposeless lie just to save yourself from shame, but then commit yourself to torture? Or do you say the truth, which won't really have any worse effect on anyone, and save yourself from the hole?
Roy's head rolled back. His eyes looked up to the ceiling.
Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes, my brother was there.
Hmm. Goring sniffed. Walter Lawrence Balcom, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Conditioning. Priming the suspect to give him truthful answers. And now came the good one. The important one.
They used a weapon, Goring said. Something that allowed them to kill my new breeds.
Roy was still looking at the ceiling, but now he blinked again, and his lips were quivering, because he knew what came next.
Roy, Goring said. Tell me about that weapon.
Roy closed his eyes, bowed his head. His breathing was unsteady. He said nothing, and the silence stretched and then snapped.
Well, Goring said, standing up. I tried.
Then he turned towards the door and began walking out. He raised his voice to the guards.
Put him back in the hole.
Roy was back in hell, and it was worse than before. Always worse because they let him come out. They let him come out and stretch his legs and be warm and be comfortable and eat food. And compared to that, the horror of the hole was fresh and poignant when before it had begun to dull in Roy's mind.
It's just your body,
Roy whimpered to himself. And silently in his mind, he began to build a mental altar, a shrine, a temple. And in this sacred place was one quintessential truth that he held above all others. It was his God. He would serve no other. I will not give them up. Not Walter, not Kaz and his team, not even the fucking Udies. Because they were all resistance, and he was not going to harm the resistance. He was not going to give them up, no matter what. No matter what, I will not give them up. And then, unwilling, his weak flesh rebelled against his spirit and pointed out, but everyone breaks eventually. Roy began to weep, quietly. No one can withstand torture forever, the weak voice continued. Everyone breaks eventually. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Roy prostrated himself before his new sacred vow that trembled and cracked and threatened at any moment to fall apart. I will not give them up.
Chapter 20.
The buzzing of a PD broke Carolyn out of her trance. She blinked and looked around as though momentarily confused. She'd been lost in thought, staring out at the gray dawn landscape around her, the city of Durham far behind them, as the car slid along back roads. Carmichael drove. Brad Hughes was in the front passenger seat. Carolyn sat in the back, feeling awkward, like she was being chauffeured. She patted her jacket, felt a PD on the inside pocket vibrating. It wasn't the PD that she had attached to her arm.
It was a secure line, PD, that only one person in the world used to contact her. Secure, but they would still speak in vague terms and coded speech out of an abundance of caution. She pulled it from its pocket and flipped the monitor to life.
Sir?
She said by way of greeting. Madam? Honeycutt's voice said back. Carolyn rubbed her eyes.
What can I do for you?
There's a problem at the place. The place being the safe house. I'm assuming you're able to speak? Carolyn felt her stomach turn over a few times and a bit of bile nipped at the back of her throat. She swallowed against it.
Yeah, I can speak.
Your Prince Charming has allowed a liability to occur. An untrusted individual was allowed to enter the premises based on a promise to the keeper of the house that the individual would be dealt with and not allowed to leave.
Dealt with?
Don't be obtuse. She said nothing. Honeycutt continued with a grunt. Then Mr. Charming allowed this individual to go. Carolyn sat there for a minute, thinking, oh, Jesus, Walter. But then she couldn't muster up the conviction to be mad at him. Because how would she have felt if he'd killed this liability? In fact, the thought of Walter letting this individual leave unharmed filled her with a certain relief, like she was coming home. He hasn't changed completely, she thought, staring out at the blushing horizon. He's still Walter. He's still my husband. And that's a good thing, isn't it?
Your turn to speak, madam, Honeycutt prompted.
Carolyn frowned at the PD in her hand.
What do you want me to say?
A sigh.
Say that you'll fix the problem.
Carolyn's lips tightened down.
The only problem I see is that an overabundance of caution caused an innocent person's life to be needlessly in danger. If Mr. Charming decided that this individual did not need to die, then I trust his decision.
Honeycutt harumphed.
Oh, you trust his decision?
Yes.
She was very close to getting snappy. She reined herself in.
Everyone thinks it's an overabundance of caution until a mini-bomb gets dropped on them. You say you trust the gentleman's decision-making? So be it. But I trust my man on the ground there, and he is quite put out by the whole thing. He is very concerned about the security of the location. And frankly, if you can't understand that, I'm concerned about the rationality of your judgment right at this moment.
I'm going to see him.
You're what?
I'm going to the place,
she stated.
To see him.
That's inadvisable.
Don't worry, sir,
Carolyn remarked with a twinge of bitterness.
It's just business. I'm not going on a romantic retreat. I have your two escorts with me.
By which she meant Hughes and Carmichael.
We're going to proceed with the operation. I believe you're already aware.
Yes, Honeycutt said. She could tell there were questions piling up behind that one-word answer, but she also knew that Honeycutt wouldn't discuss the specifics over an open line, no matter how secure.
I'm in control here,
Carolyn said, feeling that it needed to be verbalized, and then firmer.
I have everything under control.
There was a long pause of empty silence on the line.
Do you? Honeycutt asked.
Yes,
Carolyn answered, closing her eyes and summoning her confidence. Blind, unswerving confidence. The confidence of the person who speaks in faith and not from experience.
Well then,
Honeycutt was curt now.
Good luck, I suppose. And watch your back.
Yeah?
Carolyn said, opening her bleary and tired eyes and fishing in her pocket for her bottle of stems.
I will.
They arrived at the safe house just as the sun began sending shafts of light sideways through the trees, and they hung there like painted gold stripes in the dewy haze. Carolyn was not familiar with the man who ran this safe house. Honeycutt apparently was. She did not appreciate being stopped in order to hold hands and fingers out the window, all the while knowing that there was a high-caliber rifle pointed at her. But she dealt with it. These were the times that they lived in. Could she have imagined any of this when she was elbows deep in greasy dishwashing water, or stacked with plates and trays all the way up her arm as she delivered people's meals to them? No, she would never have imagined any of this. And now she could hardly imagine that old version of herself. It hadn't been so long ago, had it? It hadn't been so long since her worries were such simplicities as whether or not they could pay bills. It hadn't been so long since her brain was only occupied with how to get a day off that coincided with Walter's. And yet now it seemed very far away. There were still bills to pay, but they were paid with human lives, and there was no days off in a war. In war, there is only war. It is all-consuming and ever-present. It changes the very air that you breathe. And the light seems to come from a different star. Everything is harsher, and the shadows are deeper, and nothing is trustworthy. It changes everything, including the people that it touches. She walked into the house, followed by Carmichael and then Hughes. An old man stood at the entrance, which led into the kitchen. He did not seem pleased.
"You must be Pete,"
she said, looking past the old man to an enormous human being who stood at the counter in military tan skivvies and glanced over his shoulder at her as he poured himself coffee.
"You must be that man's wife," Pete said.
His voice was biting, but it was quiet. Carolyn got the sense that the house was still mostly asleep. Carolyn was mellow. The uptick of the stim that she'd taken kept her eyes open, but she still didn't have the energy to push back on this guy, so she simply nodded, because there was little else to do.
"Bear with me, Pete," Carolyn said. "We'll all be out of your hair soon."
"How do you plan to fix the problem?"
Carolyn just smiled.
"I plan to be out of your hair soon."
Pete's thin lips parted, then closed again. The huge man with the coffee, obviously a new breed, stepped up behind Pete and laid a massive hand on his shoulder.
"How about you ease up, Pete? Like the lady said, we'll be out of here soon."
Pete held Carolyn's gaze for a moment, then shook his head with an unintelligible grumble and turned around. Done with the conversation, he shuffled out of the kitchen. Carolyn looked up at the new breed. He didn't seem to care much that she caught him in his skivvies. He held his coffee cup in one hand, which looked comically small, and extended the other to her.
"Chief Gibbs, by the way."
Carolyn allowed her small hand to be engulfed. Gibbs pumped it once, like this was a meeting of professionals, and Carolyn found herself appreciating that. Carolyn smiled up at the man.
"Gibbs, you're enormous and slightly frightening. I can't tell you how glad I am to see you. Are there other new breeds in the house?"
Gibbs nodded.
"All six of us. The whole gang."
"God damn,"
Carolyn muttered in awe.
"Chief Kozlowski is in charge,"
Gibbs said, then took a sip of his coffee. When he brought the mug away, he gestured nonspecifically towards the house.
"Everyone's asleep, though."
Carolyn nodded.
"Let them sleep,"
she said. Gibbs looked over her shoulder at Carmichael and Hughes.
"And you, gentlemen?"
They introduced themselves. Gibbs's eyes alighted on Hughes and recognition showed.
"Oh, yeah," he said, wagging a finger at the man. "I remember you. I was with Kaz when we bailed you out of that convoy back in District 89.
Hughes looked a little surprised.
"No shit? That was you guys?
Hell, small world."
"Coffee?" Gibbs offered.
"Love some," Hughes replied. Carmichael followed. Carolyn remained standing where she was, looking out of the kitchen area and into the dining and living area. Just as Gibbs had said, there were new breeds everywhere. One was draped across a couch. Another was hunched in a chair. A couple others had chosen to sleep on the floor. One of them was snoring loudly.
"Chief Gibbs?"
Carolyn said. Gibbs looked at her and offered a knowing nod. Then he pointed across the living room to an alcove that separated two doors.
"He's in the room on the right. He was exhausted, so we gave him the bed."
Carolyn realized she was holding her hands together like a scared little girl on her first day of school. She was not projecting confidence, and she would very shortly need these men, these new breeds that expected a lot of each other and their commanders, to listen to her and respect her. She stood up straighter and let her arms fall to her sides. Gibbs observed her gather herself. His expression remained enigmatic.
"Thank you,"
Carolyn said. He lifted his coffee cup to her. "Cheers." Head up, shoulders back. She exited the kitchen, stepped lightly across the living room floor, skirted around the laid out forms of the other new breeds, and went to the alcove, and to the door on the right. She stood there for a half a second, with her hand hovering over the door, and she wasn't sure what she was so afraid of, or even if she was afraid, or if it was just the stress and the conflict and the emotions and the stims all swirling around in a cloud of anticipation that she was confusing for apprehension. Nothing seemed to make sense to her anymore. She was amazed that she'd managed to make any rational decisions at all. And there in the moment, she again didn't want to appear weak, and so she put her hand on the cold metal of the doorknob, and she gripped it, and she turned it, and she opened the door very gently, and it came open silently. The room didn't look like him. It didn't smell like him. It was dim, with the morning sunlight blocked by heavy blinds. But he was there. He was lying in the bed on his side, not even under the covers. Still fully dressed, his back was to her. One arm curled up to his chest, and the other splayed out to provide his head with something to rest on. Two perfectly good pillows sat unused at the head of the bed, which was typical of him. She closed the door behind her with painstaking quiet. She crossed the room and stood at the foot of the bed looking at him. She wanted him to be awake, but she did not want to wake him. She wanted him to be awake so that he could take away what she felt, this monstrous feeling of weighing 1,000 pounds, of feeling like the earth was pulling her into it, like her own personal gravity well was following her around, sucking her down. She didn't want to stand up straight anymore. She didn't want to appear in control anymore. She didn't want to be Stephanie. She didn't want to be POC for Durham. She didn't want any of this. She just wanted to be Carolyn. She just wanted to be Walter's wife. She went to the side of the bed that he faced. He didn't stir. His breathing was steady and even and perfect. And she sat down very slowly, still watching him, and his eyes never opened, and his breathing didn't change. And that was okay. She lowered herself down onto her side, carefully, so that she wouldn't shake the bed. And she didn't care about the new breeds outside, or the Udies, or Carmichael, or Hughes. She didn't care about the operation. She didn't care about being a leader. She didn't care about being respected. She slid herself until her back was against his chest, and her head was on his arm. And she reached back and pulled his other arm from where he'd tucked it in, and she pulled it across her like you might pull a blanket across you on a cold night, and she felt warm there. She felt his arm, felt his hand, smelled him, but said nothing. His hand found her wrist and held it, and he pulled her tighter into him. She felt his head move closer to hers and heard his intake of breath, the air brushing the back of her neck and moving her hair. She watched the unfamiliar room beyond her begin to blur, and she closed her eyes and felt the tears squeeze out of them. The rest of the world could go to hell. She was here. She was where she belonged. Carolyn, not Stephanie, not Jessica, turned into him, faced him. She sniffed wetly and looked at his face and saw that his eyes weren't dry either, but his face remained stolid and unmoved with concerted effort. Never cry, she thought. Never let them see you hurt. But you can let me see. You can let me in. She kissed him. The prickle of his goatee felt strange, but he tasted like Walter. And she didn't mind his stale breath. Both their noses were wet. She didn't mind that either. And neither did Walter. He kept holding her to him like he feared she might be ripped away. She was okay with the embrace, even if it was over-firm. Eventually, he loosened and brought his hands up to her face, and he put his palm to her cheek and his fingers planted in her hair. His eyes were drier now. He'd still not made a sound. Not sniffed. Not sobbed. His red eyes, the only indication of him feeling any emotion at all. But Carolyn knew that wasn't the whole story. It never was. It's always been for you, Walter whispered. Everything's been so I could get back to you. Carolyn closed her eyes and buckled down over the pain in her belly that dragged her down, because she knew that it was not over, and was pulling her apart. She put her hands on both sides of his head. It felt different than she was used to, because the right half of his face was smooth and hairless neoskin. But it was still him in there. They were just them. They were just people. They weren't fighters, or rebels, or renegades, or domestic terrorists, or heroes. They were just Carolyn and Walter Baucom, two people who knew more about putting seeds into dirt than they ever did about bullets and guns. How did they get here? It seemed almost incomprehensible. She couldn't open her eyes as she spoke.
You don't die, she commanded him.
She felt his head shake.
I don't plan on it, he answered.
They laid there like that for a time, until they had settled, until they both had better control of themselves, until the redness had left their eyes, until they were even keel again, because they had to go out and perform. There would come a time when they could just be alone together, but today was not that day. This was not that time. Carolyn finally opened her eyes, and they were dry and steady.
We have a war to win,
she said, and he nodded. Yeah.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Chapter 21 They'd all gathered in the living room. The shades were drawn against the morning sun so that everyone could see the image hovering in the air a little better. Gibbs had taken the liberty of making a lot of eggs and a lot of grits and a lot of coffee, and everyone had eaten and they were now sipping their coffee, standing or sitting, their faces focused in the bluish glow of the projection. Necessary introductions had been made. Small talk had been brief. Carmichael and Hughes had made the rounds. Hughes got a lot of attention. It had been Kaz's team that had pulled his ass out of the fire and rescued him from a GUV where he was headed off to DTI. Bobby was up and about, and livelier than the previous day. Her mood seemed to have settled, but Walter wasn't sure whether it was the med pack on her arm that pumped drugs into her, or whether her brain itself had started to calm. She'd taken a seat on the couch with the busy fox hunt pattern fabric beside Carolyn and Walter. Bobby and Carolyn had introduced themselves very warmly to each other, like they'd known each other for years. Walter frowned at this, but supposed it was a good thing. Getty took the armrest next to Bobby. He wasn't exactly hovering over her, but there was something protective in the way that he stuck close to her. In the center of this ragtag conglomeration of rebels, Brad Hughes stood looking at the projection. It was a map, the very same one that he'd previously shown to Carolyn. Hughes pointed to the building that was the center of their attention and drew a circle around it with his finger. "That building right there," he said. Everyone looked at it with keen interest. "That's the office of the liaison to the coalition, the OLC. Hughes scanned the room. "That's our target." Kaz, who sat in one of the kitchen chairs off to Walter's left, had his PD monitor pulled up and took studious notes on it. He peeked up over the top of his monitor. "Fed targets. Hard targets." Hughes nodded. "We gotta hit them eventually. We can't continue to engage only on their terms." He pointed to the circled building again. "Besides, the security here might surprise you." Kaz crossed one massive leg over the other and leaned back.
"Do tell."
"There's a rotunda in the center of the ground floor. Two entrances, front and back. There's also a subfloor entrance. The two entrances on the ground floor are guarded by a grand total of four soldiers who are stationed in the atrium. Two are basically pencil pushers, sidearms only. Minimal body armor, if any. Not new breeds, just normies. The two on the outside are also normies, but they're more aggressively outfitted. Subguns and soft armor. The two soldiers inside the rotunda man scanning equipment that surrounds the two entrances and alert the other soldiers if they detect weapons or bombs or whatever else gets their panties in a twist. They can also lock down the building. Single button activation. Kaz stroked his beard thoughtfully.
"I'm unfamiliar with this building. How heavily defended is the rotunda?"
"Bulletproof," Hughes replied. "Not blast proof." Kaz nodded and made a note.
"What about the subfloor entrance you mentioned?"
"More security procedures," Hughes answered, "but less guards. Same scanning equipment as the main entrances, and that entrance is guarded by another pair of soldiers, one pencil pusher, one heavy hitter. But there are more manual security clearances needed, key codes, retinal scans, etc."
"How up to date is your information?"
3 weeks, Hughes admitted. Kaz didn't look happy about that timeline.
"Is there any way we can get some more active intel? Something more recent?"
Hughes shrugged. "Well, given that everyone in this room right now is likely on a blacklist, I'd say no. No one would make it through the door."
"Well?"
Gibbs shifted his feet from where he stood and cast a smirk over the crowd to where Pete the old man sat in sullen silence at the dining room table.
"There's good old Pete."
Pete just shook his head once.
"Not a fucking chance."
Gibbs shrugged.
"Worth a try."
Kaz cleared his throat.
"Let's back up a sec. Can we get a clear-cut picture of why the fuck we're actually doing this operation? Because if it's just harassment..."
Kaz grimaced, showing his teeth.
"Then I'm not so sure we want to go on this ride with you."
Hughes clasped his hands together and looked over to Carolyn. Walter looked sideways at his wife. She sat there, staring at the map like she wasn't quite listening to the conversation. Walter gave her a tiny nudge with his leg. She inhaled deeply. Walter got the sense that she was aware of what she needed to talk about, but was simply thinking hard about how to say it. Carolyn scooted forward on the couch. She put her elbows on her knees, waved a hand in the air.
"If I didn't get a chance to meet you, I'm Carolyn Baucom, married to this guy that you already know."
She glanced down at the floor.
"My original name was Stephanie Udy. I'm the daughter of Benjamin and Jean Udy."
No one responded directly to that, but there were a few shuffling feet as everyone that was not already in the know pieced that together.
"I've managed to get myself appointed as POC for the Udy's resistance operations in Durham."
She paused again, and Walter watched his wife and could see that she was still thinking hard about how much information to mete out. When she moved on, it was with a sense of having held back.
"I will tell you this. Durham is not the push. It is not the front line. It's a distraction. It's a feint."
Kaz considered this, squinting at Carolyn with a single eye. Bobby spoke up from where she sat to Carolyn's left. Her body posture was stiff.
A lot of people have died in Durham.
Carolyn nodded. Walter saw the weight of that on Carolyn's shoulders, and he wanted to come to defend her, but also did not want to undermine her in front of everyone. He had to give her the opportunity to lead. He had to let her defend herself.
I understand that,
Carolyn said.
And that's part of the problem.
She looked around at the entire group.
You all need to understand that my control of things is a little shaky. The Udies, my parents, believe that I'm trying to prove myself to them. They are ultimately in control of what happens in Durham, as well as some other organizations. I essentially act as the middleman, the mouthpiece.
She shook her head.
I make recommendations. They are not always followed.
You said that everyone dying was part of the problem, Getty ventured. Carolyn took another steadying breath.
Yes, we're losing ground in Durham. The coax is wiping out resistance forces, and I can't convince the powers that be to invest any more manpower and resources to Durham.
Kaz was confused now and leaned forward, rubbing the side of his head like he had the beginnings of a headache. Quick question. Why are you even trying to commit more resources to Durham if it's a losing battle and not even the objective in the first place? Carolyn turned to him.
Because Coax County is the objective,
she stated.
That's what we want.
She spun her hands like a paddle wheel going in reverse.
Let me back up here.
She closed her eyes for a second, centering herself. When she opened them, she was refocused.
As we speak, the Sino-Russian part of the coalition is attempting to secure support for a troop surge in order to quell the recent spate of uprisings that we've caused. They're close to getting it, although some members of the international community are still waffling. But they are close, and when those troops come, they come into the States through one route.
Kaz nodded. Coax County. Carolyn pointed to him.
Correct.
Coax County is a very hard target, Kaz said. Do the Udies honestly believe that they can take it? With the little sliver of the military we've got hiding in the mountains?
Yes, they believe it,
Carolyn said, and her voice was firm.
And I do, too.
She held up a staying hand.
I'm not a backer of the Udies. You need to all trust me that there's very little love lost in that relationship. But I know what they're planning, and I know it can work. And if we can make it work, it is our best possibility of stopping the coax, of putting an end to it altogether.
Kaz tilted his head and appeared to be preparing another remark. Walter was about to give in and interject on his wife's behalf, but she took care of it herself. She extended a hand to Kaz and spoke up, putting more steel into her voice.
Just let me finish, Chief. You can grill me with questions afterward, but let me get the whole thing out first, okay?
Kaz relinquished the words on his tongue and bowed toward Carolyn in a please continue motion. Carolyn addressed the group again.
Durham is a decent target. It's adjacent to the state capital. It's reasonable that the resistance would want to take it over. It's not so reasonable that they would try to take over Coax County because Kaz, you're right, it's a hard target. But these preconceptions are what play into our favor. If we can sell them hard enough on the resistance trying to take Durham, then we can get them to mobilize out of Coax County. If things start to look like they're going down the drain in Durham, that's going to be the coalition's knee-jerk reaction, to throw everything they have and stabilize that place. Once that happens, the renegade forces hiding in West Virginia move into Coax County and take it over. With the coalition's main hub disrupted, it'll stall the troop surge, long enough for us to convince more of the Fed military to defect. And they are ready. More of them are ready. And when they defect, even more will come over. It'll be a snowball effect. But we have to show a victory. And in order to show that victory, we have to first convince the coax that they're losing control of Durham.
Carolyn gestured to the map.
That is why we want to hit the office of the liaison of the coalition, she said. Specifically, we want to hit it with new breeds.
Kaz's expression had changed as Carolyn had spoken. It had gone from skepticism to thoughtfulness. He wasn't buying it yet, but he wasn't rejecting it outright either. He had a finger pressed against his lips and regarded the map projection with squinted, calculating eyes. You want us to be seen, Kaz stated. Carolyn nodded.
Absolutely.
You want us to be seen taking that shit over? Because you want the coax to think that Colonel Wainwright is mobile with his renegades and moving on Durham, which will start the panic, which will cause that knee-jerk reaction, which will empty out Coax County.
He smiled knowingly.
If it all goes according to plan.
Yes,
Carolyn affirmed. Kaz looked at her.
You know that it never goes according to plan.
Carolyn looked him right in the eye, and Walter got a glimpse of someone that wasn't his wife, or with some hidden aspect of her that he'd never seen.
You know as well as I do that you still make plans. You just adapt and overcome when they go to shit. That's what we've all been trying to do. Adapting and overcoming. The plan didn't work out like I wanted it to, or the Udies wanted it to. But then somehow, miraculously, a team of new breeds lands in my lap and gives me a viable plan B.
Carolyn spread her hands.
So this is me, adapting and overcoming.
Kaz considered, then accepted, then turned to Hughes.
Okay, tell me more.
Macy was pretty sure she was going to puke. She kept glancing around the room for something to put that puke into, but there was nothing. Not a trash can, not a bag, nothing. And yet she kept looking for something, like she thought it might magically appear. The room was small, windowless, institutional. Just enough room for a table and a few chairs. If you backed your chair all the way out from the table, it would hit the wall. Everything was painted gray. The floors were industrial carpet tiling, charcoal. There was the little cup sitting on the table in front of her, the one they'd brought her water in, but that was way too small to contain everything if she puked. Her stomach turned, clenched. Her hands trembled. The room felt stupidly cold. She closed her eyes and told herself to calm down. You're not gonna throw up. Everything is gonna be fine. This is the right thing to do. You have nothing to worry about because this is the right thing to do. But Macy wasn't sure whether she believed that. Those had been James's words, not hers. It's the right thing to do, Macy. She'd protested without much conviction, because she just wasn't sure. This was the problem with sitting on the fence. Eventually, you had to make a choice of what side of the pasture you wanted to be on. And if you sat on that fence your whole life, then that decision came hard and difficult. Apparently, it hadn't taken James very long to decide.
I'm going to the police,
he said, the second they were away from the safe house.
What?
Macy was incredulous.
Didn't you hear what Kaz said?
Yeah. James's face darkened. I heard him make threats against my person.
James.
Macy fumbled for something, anything to get him to back down because her stomach was starting to twist.
Macy?
James was angry with her now.
They just held us hostage in a rebel safe house for a day. And before that, they had me kidnapped and hogtied in your apartment. These are not good people.
But they were going to kill you, Macy thought, and didn't say. And then they didn't.
I know, but there's no buts, Macy.
James hunkered over the wheel and stared straight ahead with a furrowed brow and pursed lips.
It's the right thing to do. We are not rebels. The Fed is going to see that my PD was used to contact other rebels, and unless we go and clear the air, we're going to be the next target. You understand that, right? You owe nothing to those people. Nothing.
You'll be the next target, Macy thought. But then she realized that James would give her up. He would. She knew it for sure. And the second that she knew it, she knew something else, too.
James,
she said, her voice hollow and without inflection.
What? I don't think we can be together.
Macy stared straight ahead at the road. To her left, he'd commandeered the wheel from her in a fit of anger. She saw James's head turning rapidly in her peripheral vision, now looking at the road, now looking at her. The road, her, the road, her.
Are you serious?
He said.
Yes, I'm serious,
she snapped. There was a very long pause.
I was bringing you flowers for our date,
he said,
when your friends kidnapped me.
Macy whirled on him.
You think I give a fuck about flowers?
She yelled, bawling her fists.
Fuck your flowers, James. You would have let me take the fall for all of this. You didn't even fucking try to have my back.
James shifted, the weight of the accusation making him uncomfortable.
Well,
he said, this was your idea.
This was not my idea,
she shouted.
James, I swear to God, if you go around telling people that this was my fucking idea, then what?
James faced her, heedless of the road now. You're gonna send your goon boyfriend after me?
He's not my fucking boyfriend.
James just made a raspberry and a spray of his spittle landed on her cheek.
I'm gonna fucking kill him.
She reached across the center console and gave him two solid right hooks to the shoulder.
Ow!
He exclaimed, trying to back away from her and causing the car to swerve.
Ow, stop! You piece of shit!
She yelled in his face.
I was trying to protect you! Everything I did was trying to protect you, and then you turn around at the first fucking opportunity and you throw me under the bus. God damn it! You're such a little bitch!
There was more yelling, but right about then was when the blue lights started twinkling in their mirrors, and the two occupants of the vehicle realized that they were being pulled over. It took him a second, but then James pulled to the side of the road. Two officers approached, subguns trained on the car. James and Macy waited in bitter silence. The second that the primary officer reached the lowered driver's side window, James blurted out,
"We just escaped from a rebel safe house. We can show you where it is."
And now here she was, in a police interview room, going on hour number 3, or was it 4? Regardless, you would think that the urge to vomit and the nerves that brought it on would have passed by now, but they hadn't. They stayed with her like cloying humidity after an August rainstorm. The police officers had interviewed them on the side of the road. Then they'd called detectives and supervisors. Eventually, they decided to take them downtown and put them in separate interview rooms. Once in those rooms, the detectives interviewed them again. Actually, Macy couldn't say what they were doing with James. She just assumed that he was being interviewed as well as her. But she did notice that there was an overall accusatory tone that they'd taken with her, not treating her like a victim of coercion and kidnapping at all. And she couldn't help but wonder what the hell that James was telling them. Maybe I shouldn't have broken it off with him. Could he be so petty as to risk sending her to DTI because she'd broken up with him? Yes. Yes, he could. After a second and third round of questions from the same detective, the detective had disappeared for a while. He'd stuck his head in to ask her if she needed anything, and she'd requested water. Then he'd brought her a cup of water and told her that someone was coming to speak with her, but he didn't explain who. He'd not been back for an hour and a half now, although the time was just a pure guess on her part. There were no clocks in the room, and they'd taken her PD from her. She folded her arms over her chest and stared at the wall. She realized that she was grimacing against the feeling in her stomach, and she tried to make her face neutral but wasn't sure if she succeeded. Her thoughts were all over the place. She thought about James and had feelings of guilt. You shouldn't have busted on him like that in the car when you were both stressed out. He can't handle things like that. He's a softer man than Kaz was, and that's what you liked about him. But then she would get pissed again thinking about James, first throwing her under the bus and now probably selling her out. You're such a little bitch of a man. I know Kaz was a psychopath, but maybe I swung way too far on the pendulum when I went to you. And then, of course, she would have to start thinking about what was going to happen to Kaz. Oh my God, does he really deserve what he's about to get? And what is it that he's about to get? Are they going to... And finally, she realized with a jolt, she was worried about herself as well. Oh, fuck. What are they going to do to me? She'd heard the stories, of course, but she hadn't necessarily believed them, and they'd always been so ardently denied by the Fed-controlled media. Now, when it was her neck on the chopping block, those things that seemed like dark conspiracy theories suddenly started seeming like they could be very true. After all, people were rebelling against the government, weren't they? She recalled what Javon had said about the war becoming worse, and eventually the people sitting on the fence were going to have to pick a side. Many people had already picked their side, and it seemed that a lot of them opposed the coax. There had to be a reason behind that. It couldn't just be because they were all mistaken. It couldn't just be because they were all crazy domestic terrorists. Walter hadn't seemed crazy. She swallowed hard against a thick, slimy feeling in her throat. This was all going very, very wrong. She filled her lungs and then blew it all out and smoothed her hands along her thighs, trying to tell herself to calm down. She would be able to explain her way out of this. But then at the same time starting to panic, because how much longer were they going to keep her in this fucking room in the silence by herself just sitting and fucking stewing? And right about the time that the panic rose far enough to make the back of her neck feel hot, and for sweat to start eking out along her hairline, the door to the interview room opened and a man walked in. It was not the detective. It was a different man. He was dressed well in a blue suit, French-cuffed shirt. He had a very calm, very pleasant demeanor. He closed the door behind him with the care of someone not wanting to disturb a meeting already in progress. She heard the latch click into place. He turned to her and smiled. He approached the table with a single stride, pulled out the chair, and began to sit in it. "Macy Stockwell?" he asked, extending a hand to her. She leaned forward and shook it. Her own hands were cold and clammy. His were warm and dry. He had a firm handshake, but not hard.
"Yes,"
she said. The man sat fully in his seat and rested his immaculate elbows on the stainless steel surface of the table. She watched the way he sat, very erect, and the way he held himself, and part of her was relieved, because he seemed so very civilized that he could not possibly do anything bad to her. But then another part of her was very unsure, because it all seemed very thin. "Special Agent Goring, The man introduced himself in a rote sort of way and then continued as though it was an afterthought. Regional agent in command.
Oh.
She shuffled her feet beneath a chair, tried on a faltering smile.
Do I really warrant that much attention?
Agent Goring lifted a single eyebrow. It seemed like he was amused by what she'd said. Then he tapped the